Hello, I'm Tony Randall, and I'm in the commercial team at Shoesmiths. And I'm joined for this webinar by Simon McArdle, who leads the commercial service line at Shoesmiths. Welcome to this webinar, in which we will be covering some important recent developments in commercial contracts. We'll be discussing the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act, otherwise known as CIGA. And then we'll be having a look at the impact of Brexit on commercial contracts. So, as our time is short and we have a lot to cover, we'll move straight into our discussion on CIGA. Simon.
Thank you, Tony. Okay, so starting with CIGA, the focus on this section will be the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act, also known as CIGA. Before we get into it, though, I think it's probably useful to give you a bit of background to set the scene for CIGA. There is no doubt about it. COVID-19 has upended our economy. The government has been busily putting in place attempted corrective measures, and as a result, we saw a flurry of laws being passed by Parliament at, frankly, breakneck speed. One such law, CIGA, amends the treatment of insolvency and restructuring contracts in the UK on both a temporary and permanent basis. And now, in particular, the new law, which came into effect in June of this year, has introduced permanent changes to the way that termination clauses will work in supply contracts. And this is really important because commercial supply contracts historically typically contain clauses in them which state in one way or another that a supplier can terminate the agreement if an insolvency-related event occurs, or even in some cases, if an event is threatened or suspected. These type of clauses, often called ipso facto clauses, are added by legal advisors such as myself, because in the absence of an express contractual right to terminate for such events, a party does not have a common law right to do so. And so within this section, we are going to look at some of the key changes from introduced by CIGA. Most notably is the bar on a supplier of goods and services terminating a contract with its customer. And we can also touch on some of the other points to note. The new form of company moratorium, it sits outside of the insolvency regime. It can be, but does not have to be, a precursor to insolvency, and the introduction of the new restructuring plan. So that's the scene set.
So Simon, it sounds as though this legislation's got quite a big job to do. Is it going to achieve it?
Well, that's the big question, Tony. And frankly, only time will tell in that respect. I mean, there is no doubt about it. Suppliers and customers can't exist without each other. They are the classic symbiotic relationship. But this tethering together is a big step. As it happens, I wrote an article on this topic back in July, shortly after the law came into effect. And I drew an analogy with the popular film Titanic, everyone's favorite, and the infamous driftwood scene at the end. Now, just to remind you, let's try not to get too emotional, but Jack decided that the driftwood would not take both of their weight. So he let himself sink into the ocean to save Rose. And the question is, could Rose have shifted over slightly to let Jack onto the driftwood? Was there space? Would they both have frozen? Who knows? But in this case, the government has suppliers and customers nuzzled together on that driftwood, and we've just got to hope that it keeps everybody afloat. So with that analogy in mind, let's move on to see how buoyant this driftwood is going to be. So moving on to the next slide. The new moratorium. CIGA applies to contracts for the supply of goods and services, including contracts entered into before CIGA came into effect. And it will also apply where a customer becomes subject to a relevant insolvency procedure on or after 26 June 2020. But the big feature of CIGA is the new moratorium. So there is no need for any existing or subsequent insolvency process. And where a winding up petition has been presented already, there is a need to apply to the court. It will last up to 20 days, and an insolvency practitioner is appointed to monitor the moratorium. An extension can be obtained for up to 20 days without creditor consent, but with creditor consent, it can last up to 12 months.
So why is there no need for any existing insolvency process?
So I can't necessarily speak to what was in the minds of the legislators at the time, but it really does speak to the intention of this act being survival. It's there to give a new piece of driftwood, a new life raft for companies without having to go through that formal insolvency process. So that's why I think there is that divorce between insolvency and the moratorium. So moving on to the next slide, where we're going to look at key effects. So the key effects on the company under SIGA are: there is a payment holiday in respect of all pre-moratorium debts. During the moratorium, they must pay for goods and services supplied during the moratorium. They must pay rent, they must pay wages, they must pay their employee salaries, and they must also pay financial services contracts such as bank loans. Provided they do all of that, the moratorium will protect them. And that protection has certain key effects on creditors. So the creditors, they cannot commence insolvency proceedings. They cannot commence or continue any legal proceedings. They cannot enforce securities. They cannot repossess goods or premises. They cannot crystallize a floating charge. They cannot enforce judgments, and they cannot terminate the relevant agreement. Now, specifically, if a termination event has occurred pre-insolvency, but the supplier has not, so pre-insolvency or pre-moratorium, but the supplier has not yet acted on it, by the time the customer goes into those proceedings or into that moratorium, then the supplier will lose the right to exercise its termination or do anything else for that matter, as articulated in that list, in relation to the insolvency or the moratorium.
So if a supplier can't enforce those rights, doesn't that increase the supplier's risk that the customer's financial position will worsen even further during the moratorium? It sounds to me like the driftwood's been whipped away and Jack's sinking rapidly to the bottom.
I think the practical reality, Tony, is that, yes, it's a real risk. There are mitigations in there. So anything procured during the moratorium, those debts must be paid in order to preserve the moratorium. So that's a mitigating step. And debts incurred or debts accrued during that moratorium period will take a much higher standing than they otherwise would. In fact, that they will be preferred even to the insolvency practitioner's debts throughout that period. But it is nevertheless a significant risk for suppliers. There is the financial risk of continuing to supply when ultimately they still might go bust. In fact, around about the time that the legislation came out, the government issued its best estimate of the cost to suppliers. And the figure that they came up with was 292.9 million over 10 years. It wasn't quite clear how they calculated that figure. It could be the increased insurance premiums. It could be the costs of legal proceedings. It could also be the lost cost, the lost debts that would not be recoverable. But it is a significant sum, and it is a significant ongoing risk for creditors. So let's move on to the next slide, which is the applicability of SIGA. So SIGA is likely to apply to most contracts for the supply of goods and services, although there are limited exclusions for example, for essential supplies. Now, essential supplies broadly defined as gas, electricity and water, but also communication services. So those are goods and services for the purposes of enabling or facilitating anything to be done by electronic means, so computer hardware, software, IT, advice, tech assistance, data storage, that kind of stuff.
I wanted to jump in, Si, but why are those particular services excluded from SIGA? You'd have thought that they are some of the most fundamental services to ensure continuity of the business.
Well, there isn't really anything new there. Essential supplies have long been excluded. This dates back to the Insolvency Act back in 1986. So utilities were excluded then. And then under the Insolvency Protection of Essential Supplies Order in 2015, that was extended to the provisions of electronic services. And you may recall at the time it was proclaimed that Wi-Fi is the new water. So the two things were tethered together from back in 2015. That regime still continues, and that regime will apply to essential supplies, irrespective of SIGA. But anything outside of that, SIGA will apply. So let's move on to the next stage, and we get down into the nuts and bolts of the contractual considerations. So this is where you and I come into our own, Tony. Certain clauses that you may wish to consider within your contracts to help deal with the SIGA concerns. And some clauses that you may wish to consider are termination for pre-insolvency steps, or termination for financial position deteriorating. That can be by reference to a third party credit reference score, or by reference to your own suspicions as to their credit worthiness, depending on your bargaining position and the ability to get the kind of language that would suit you. Termination for convenience. The old faithful, if you can terminate a contract at any time for any reason, then that would be enormously effective. And termination for non-payment, of course. Typically, under commercial contracts, historically, there's been relatively generous timescales applied for non-payment. I suspect that's something that parties may look at and reconsider in the post-SIGA world. Equally, you should be looking for a requirement to provide regular financial information. So that includes notification of any pre-insolvency or insolvency events, just so you are aware of the customer's standing at any given time. And also, less generous payment terms may well be appropriate. So payment or part payment in advance, payment by installments, reducing payment periods, which we were certainly observing in the market, were creeping up and up and up. They need to snap back to make credit management a little bit more robust and to help mitigate against that SIGA effect. And there's also structural considerations. So rather than your traditional long-term supply contract for any and all orders, which must be forecasted and then accepted, perhaps structuring the contract as a series of independent contracts might help manage the risk. So a supplier would be free to decline opportunities on a case-by-case basis.
Simon, so obviously all those contractual mechanisms can be used to mitigate, to protect the supplier's position. But more simply, if both parties are minded to do so, can they simply contract out of SIGA?
No, you can't contract out of SIGA. And what these provisions are there to do is to manage that risk. Ultimately, if the moratorium is obtained or insolvency is proceeded, the SIGA drawbridge goes down, and much of these protections wouldn't help you then. This is about being able to make an informed decision before it is too late under the new SIGA regime. So moving on then to the next slide, where we look at some practical considerations and some practical steps that that businesses may wish to take. It is essential to review your supply contracts to get a sense of what the risk profile is of your nexus of contracts in the new post-SIGA world. And it may be appropriate to amend some of the standard form templates, but critically review the internal processes for enforcement of the terms set out in those templates. You should consider training for contract managers, so those that are at the coalface, so to speak, know what they should do and should not do if a customer shows signs of financial distress. Because again, you can have the best templates in the world, but if they are not being adhered to and not being applied in accordance with current law and custom, it's not going to help the business, and you may find yourself inadvertently in breach of contract, looking to exercise rights that no longer exist because of the law. At the outset of relationships, consider greater due diligence on customers at that pre-contractual stage. And of course, continue to monitor the customer and monitor their payment performance and financial position as you move through the relationship. Ensure that invoices are paid when due and tighten debt collection procedures. Now is the time to be really on top of your debt collection, and also consider invoice financing options, trade credit insurance. There are products on the market that exist that can be enormously helpful in these kind of circumstances.
So there's obviously quite a lot suppliers can do and should be doing on top of the risk that they're inevitably going to be taking through SIGA. Do you think that their suppliers are going to start passing cost increases through to their customers to take account of the risk and all the additional due diligence they're going to be doing?
I think it's going to be interesting to see how the market reacts, but it does strike me as a strong possibility that with this new risk, is that risk just going to be priced into contracts going forward? That ultimately these kind of issues end up on the bottom line somewhere. So that then takes us to the final slide on this section, which is the future. So the wider considerations for SIGA, the intention here was to allow businesses to trade through difficulties and difficulties that have been generated as a result of the COVID pandemic. But the effect and the law of unforeseen consequences are that many suppliers might seek to be much more proactive in managing their contracts and start to reserve their rights to terminate when they want for convenience, or if insolvency is merely threatened or suspected. So it's a very different atmosphere that will be created as a result of SIGA. And of course, we should bear in mind that too aggressive management of this may ironically push businesses into insolvency earlier than would otherwise have been the case, because a culture of trust and partnership is damaged as a result of this heightened due diligence and very careful observation of each other's financial profile. And as I touched on previously, the full impact of the Act just won't really become clear until the market is at a proper opportunity to react to the new processes and the courts have had a proper opportunity to pass their judgment onto how certain sections work. And I think time will tell. There was a number of temporary measures within SIGA that were intended to come to an end back in September 2020. They were extended to the end of the year, and they've now been extended to the end of Q1 2021. So the impact of SIGA is definitely unclear at this stage. And of course, speaking of things that are important yet incredibly unclear, Mr. Randall, I believe you're going to talk about Brexit.
Indeed, yes. Thank you for reminding me. Let's see if in the course of talking about Brexit, I can introduce some Titanic analogies or possibly some other major cinematic productions. Gladiator, perhaps. Let's see. So typically, a training session on commercial contract updates might focus on the main case law developments over the last year. But this year, we have something that will impact commercial contracts more than all the contract law cases over the last 10 years combined. And that is, of course, Brexit. With effect from the end of this year, the transition period will expire and the UK will enter a brave new world and break away from our long trading relationship as part of the EU. And that potentially has a very large impact on the commercial contracts that we all advise on. So, moving through the slides, looking first at the purely legal effects of Brexit, at 11 p.m. on the 31st of December, it's specified by reference to European time rather than UK time, of course, 11 p.m. on the 31st of December. The UK will effectively bring back onshore its lawmaking powers in those areas previously outsourced to the EU. And we will repatriate all relevant EU laws to become UK laws. So after 31st of December, the UK may well start to change some of those laws so that the laws of the UK start to diverge from those of the EU. And that has, of course, been a major source of contention in the recent trade talks because it could lead to UK businesses having a competitive advantage compared to EU businesses. So the effects of that future divergence of laws are likely to be complicated and highly numerous. So we all look forward to them with eager anticipation. But in fact, Brexit is likely to have only very limited effect on English contract law because our contract law is almost exclusively derived from English common law and not from EU legislation. So the far greater impact of Brexit on commercial agreements will not be so much legal as commercial. And in this part of our webinar, we're going to run through some of the aspects of commercial contracts that we, Simon and I, are increasingly finding are being impacted by Brexit.
Tony, if I could just jump in on that one. Obviously, you and I come at this from our perspective as commercial contract lawyers. How do you think that the impact on commercial contracts stacks up against our colleagues in other areas, so real estate, corporate, employment?
Well, employment, of course, have got an awful lot to contend with in terms of the new immigration rules and settled status. But corporate transactions, unless they're international transactions, of course, corporate documentation and real estate documentation, frankly, isn't as impacted as our commercial agreements. And I suppose you could understand that because commercial agreements tend to be longer term rather than single point in time transactions. And secondly, because commercial contracts, by definition, have more commercial provisions in them. And particularly, of course, contracts for the movement of goods, the sale and purchase of goods crossing borders. So I think commercial contracts inevitably are going to be impacted more heavily. So let's move on to have a look at some of the commercial effects of Brexit then. Now, as we're going through these commercial aspects, do please remember that context is absolutely everything in a commercial contract. So, although we hope that what we talk about here may be the aspects most commonly arising to consider, there could well be additional points that you will need to take into account. And that may include aspects specific to the sector with which you're dealing, such as specific laws that apply now or are made in the future, that impact a particular sector. For example, we already know that financial services will be heavily affected by Brexit. Also, check if the UK government has published any relevant guidance or notices relating to that sector. And also, has any guidance been produced by sector representative bodies, trade bodies? Always worth checking. Also, there may be aspects specific to the subject matter of the contract to take into account. For example, contracts regarding the supply or transportation of chemicals or certain food products may be impacted by specific rules, again, including new rules in the future. And there may be specific aspects relating to one or more of the parties that you need to consider. For example, contracts with public bodies or contracts with consumers may require special consideration. So remember, it's really important to consider the context. One size does not fit all.
Yeah, just to echo that, Tony, this really is an incredibly pervasive and nuanced area, and it, albeit a good summary of the key issues, that what we are touching on in this section really is the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, as far as Brexit goes. It takes us back to Titanic, doesn't it?
well done.
There we go. We did it.
You got there. Okay, look, let's move on and have a look at some of the specific commercial impacts that we're coming across quite frequently in our discussions with clients. Performance risk. Now, one of the most obvious issues is the risk that Brexit will affect one or both parties' ability to perform the contract, either temporarily, perhaps due to initial delays at ports, or even permanently, less likely perhaps, but for example, if a permanent embargo is imposed, or if it becomes unlawful to supply the goods or services in question. So you need to consider the impacts of those types of disruption. Will they lead to liquidated damages under the contract or to service credits under some sort of payment mechanism? Might they result in a right to terminate arising? Many businesses have already done due diligence on their most important contracts to assess whether these things might be triggered. Supply chain. How might your client's business be affected by disruption in their supply chain? Do your clients' contracts give them the remedies they might need? Do your clients need to enter into backup contracts with other suppliers less susceptible to performance risk? These are all things that our clients have been working hard on planning for, particularly those reliant on just-in-time supplies. Market conditions. There are so many Brexit-related factors that might affect the markets in which our clients are operating, and in turn might affect the performance and commerciality of their contracts, such as whether the price will remain competitive, how the market for raw materials might be affected, will they become scarce? The availability of warehousing has been a major contentious issue over the last 2 or 3 years, and many others. And all those factors may start to impact on the duration of contracts, and an increasing tendency to build in rights to voluntary termination or other termination triggers to ensure that our clients are not locked in to commitments that could turn unfavourable due to unpredictable market conditions. Border controls and customs formalities. This is probably the area where most uncertainty and risk lies currently, in the absence of any trade deal with the EU having been agreed at the time we're recording this webinar. And not surprisingly, because this could lead to, obviously, increased costs due to tariffs, but also increased costs due to processes and paperwork, increased time for getting goods and indeed people across borders, and the potential for quotas to be imposed, and even trade sanctions and embargoes. And remember, even if your client itself is not importing or exporting goods with the EU, your client's suppliers might be susceptible to these uncertainties, which in turn might impact on your client by their suppliers failing to perform, or perhaps your client's suppliers seeking to pass cost or risk onto your clients. The freedom to provide services, new restrictions may apply to the provision of certain services to EU countries, and added costs may be incurred, or service provision may have to stop completely. And unfortunately, that is one of the effects of the UK no longer having the fundamental freedom to provide services throughout the EEA. And it could also prevent EU businesses, of course, from continuing to provide services to your clients in the UK. Labour market and free movement of people, another area where Brexit will have high impact on many industries and the commercial contracts made in them, will be the new restrictions on free movement of people. And that is both on people currently in the UK who might not have the right to remain here or who need to complete paperwork to do so, but also on future recruits under the new immigration rules that are to be introduced. And the impact that all this will have on the labour market, and therefore the cost of contracts involving labour-intensive services, remains to be seen. So we can anticipate perhaps the use of pricing mechanisms that adjust contract price based on labour costs. And place of performance, the combination of restrictions on freedom to provide services and the effects on labour cost also means that contracts that specify a place for performance of the contract may need to be renegotiated to allow a supplier more flexibility in order to be able to continue to perform the contract either at all or cost effectively. Let's move on to look at a few more common issues. Licenses, permits and consents. Bear in mind that UK businesses may no longer benefit from EU-wide approval schemes, and also new licenses and approvals may be required under new UK legislation in the future. Delays and costs in obtaining any new licenses might need to be factored into contract terms and pricing. Tariffs. Well, tariffs are, of course, the first risk you think about in the context of commercial contracts. And where we end up on that subject, as I record this webinar, I just can't say. But the implications are potentially far-reaching. Obviously, if your client is an importer or an exporter to or from the EU, then this is highly relevant. But also, if your client is trading with the country outside the EU, then the new tariffs may apply when the UK is no longer able to benefit from those trade agreements that those countries have made with the EU in the past. Because once we leave the EU, of course, we lose the benefit of any existing trade agreements the EU has entered into. Now, the UK is in the course of negotiating its own new trade agreements with a large number of countries. I think so far, out of the 70 or so countries that the UK trades with, typically, that the EU had trade agreements with, I think the UK has now negotiated new agreements with 50 or so of those 70 countries. So we're not doing badly, although the UK has had rather longer than originally anticipated to negotiate those new trade agreements. And as I mentioned earlier, even if your client doesn't import or export itself, your client's suppliers might seek to pass on their additional tariff costs to your clients. Exchange rates. Obviously, we might start to see bigger swings in sterling euro exchange rates. So that might start to find its way more into price adjustment mechanisms or into the choice of currency for commercial contracts. Regulatory, some regulatory change will apply from the 1st of January, and other changes may begin to appear if and when UK law begins to diverge from EU law. But one change worth noting in particular at this stage is that businesses that import goods that are placed on the market in the UK will be treated as importers now, even if previously they would have been treated as distributors. And with that comes additional obligation and responsibility, including potential criminal liability, and also mutual recognition of standards between the UK and EU countries will not automatically continue. So there are potentially a lot of regulatory changes that may impact the supply chain and therefore the contracts in that chain. And VAT, although the UK will not be required to retain VAT, it's clear that the UK government intends to retain VAT, although of course some details may change in the future. But it's just worth noting a couple of points of detail on VAT. There is government guidance about some changes that will apply after the end of transition, 31st December, such as postponing accounting for import tax on goods brought into the UK, and also the distance selling rules will cease to apply. There'll be a new VAT regime that will apply to overseas sellers selling goods in the GB marketplace. Time now doesn't permit us to go into any more detail than that, which we're probably all relieved about. Other factors, just from the aspects that we've covered already, it's obvious that there are so many factors at play that potentially impact on pricing and risk allocation in commercial contracts, and may need to be factored into the drafting far more explicitly going forward than they have been typically to date.
Tony, sorry to jump in there. I mean, as you've said yourself, vast amount to consider, even at the commercial considerations level. What's your general take on when businesses should start to engage with legal advisors on these issues?
Yeah, well, I mean, the trite answer is sooner rather than later, and we are now just a couple of weeks before transition ends, and we enter the brave new world. The reality is that some huge corporates have been dealing with this already since the referendum result. The vast majority of businesses, though, have had bigger problems to think about, or more immediate problems to think about, over the last 9 months, and they've been struggling and devoting most of their resources to dealing with COVID, and only now really are starting to be able to apply the resource to consider what the implications of Brexit are. I think the word of encouragement I would give to all of them is it's never too late to start looking at this, and you can't avoid looking at it. But I think it's a good idea to get a trusted advisor on board alongside you to guide you through what is an incredibly complicated maze. Okay, so if all that wasn't enough, the next slide is just a few other aspects that clients are raising with us quite often. Incoterms. As you know, Incoterms are a standardized set of international trade terms that are used a lot in international trade of goods. They've been developed carefully over years, and they allocate risks in a very balanced way. And Brexit could have the effect of upsetting that risk allocation. So think about whether your client's use of Incoterms needs to be reviewed. And that includes their use for certain third countries, not just with the EU. Rules of origin. Again, I'm not going to say much about rules of origin, as they could constitute a whole training session in their own right, save to say that they will apply whether or not a trade deal is struck with the EU, although their form will be different whether or not we are on WTO terms or on a trade deal with the EU. Yet another thing to factor into your client's commercial contracts. Data protection. Well, similarly, we could spend at least an hour, if not half a day, talking about data protection in the context of Brexit. But for this webinar, I'll just say that in many commercial agreements, it will be important to ensure that the parties are complying both with EU DP laws and with UK DP laws, as they will be distinct legal regimes. So ensure that your DP clauses are up to scratch to capture that point. And defining territories. Often commercial agreements will define a territory by reference to the EU or EEA. So a couple of issues arise. First, does the contract intend the UK to continue to be in the territory as defined after 31st December? And secondly, is the contract referring to the countries comprising the EU when the contract was signed, or those contracts in the EU from time to time in the future? The point there is we need to be more careful in our drafting of that definition going forward. Governing law. I think this is the first bit of good news that I've talked about so far in the webinar. Good news is that the party's choice of English law will still generally be respected going forward under the Rome Conventions. Jurisdiction. Not so much. Slightly more complicated is the position on choice of jurisdiction. And there remains some doubt whether exclusive jurisdiction clauses will be enforceable if entered into before the 1st of January 2021. That's when the UK will accede to the Hague Convention in its own right, rather than as part of the EU. And the practical effect of that, we have seen, has been that some clients have preferred to adopt arbitration clauses in their commercial contracts over court jurisdiction.
So, Tony, in view of the areas where there's a lot of movement and a lot of unknown, how specific or how certain can we be when giving advice on this stuff at this stage?
Well, in terms of governing law, as I say, that is pretty concrete because the Rome Conventions are Rome 1 and Rome 2 both apply to help with certainty in that respect. But I find it quite extraordinary that at this stage in the game, we still don't know whether an exclusive jurisdiction clause in a contract made in England under English law will actually be enforceable in Europe. But there we are. That's just one of many uncertainties, unfortunately. So let's move on and have a look at how our clients are starting to deal with various of these risks in their contracts. What mitigations are they building into their contracts? Binding supply and purchase obligations. Customers have tried to secure committed supplies at fixed prices, but not surprisingly, that's the last thing most suppliers are in any position to accept at the moment, given all the uncertainties that can impact to increase their costs. Brexit clauses. We've all heard about, we've all seen Brexit clauses, hardship clauses, material adverse change clauses. We've seen a few contracts that seek to include a get-out clause triggered in some way by the effects of Brexit. But I must say I have not seen many actually make their way into signed contracts. Is that your experience too, Simon?
Yeah, I think we were all expecting a huge swell of Brexit clauses coming down the pipe. But in practice, it just hasn't been the case. Difficult to put your finger on exactly why that is, aside from perhaps the massive amount of uncertainty that there's been. We've all been on tenterhooks for so long now that it's difficult to amend a template or to have specific wording in a commercial contracts context that you know is going to be robust and will work into 2021.
Yeah, exactly. Change control clauses. Some contracts, of course, have specific change control clauses that might help one or other party to request a change to a contract, but normally at a price. And if that price isn't acceptable, then that often gives a party a right to terminate. That might operate to get some parties out of trouble. Statutory references and change of law. We've seen some attempts to safeguard a supplier by only obliging them to comply with laws as they exist at the date of the contract, or specifically providing for price increases if there is an adverse change in law. But they tend to be only built into longer term contracts where the supplier would otherwise be locked in with absolutely no escape mechanism whatsoever. And duration, termination, and exclusivity. Of course, we shouldn't forget that the shorter the duration of a contract, the less chance there is of unexpected risks arising during the term. And whether or not there are exclusivity rights or obligations to commit to purchase or supply are highly relevant. And let's not forget that giving the parties a right of voluntary termination is probably the ultimate get out of jail card for both of them. Lastly, let's have a look at whether contract law will give a party relief if they're suffering adverse effects from Brexit. And the quick answer to that is not very likely. Interpretation. English law takes a strict approach to interpretation, so the parties will probably find themselves bound to the words of the contract they agreed in the first place, even if circumstances subsequently change. Implied terms. Will terms be implied to give relief? Well, unlikely, because except for contracts entered into before 2016 at the latest, the parties ought to have been in contemplation of Brexit. And so the courts will be reluctant to imply terms to rescue them in those circumstances. Frustration. Will frustration come to the rescue? Well, again, the courts, English courts, set a high bar for frustration so that pretty much anything short of absolute impossibility to perform the contract is unlikely to be held to frustrate a contract. There was a high court case, actually, in 2019, brought by the European Medicines Agency, who tried to get out of their 25-year lease in Canary Wharf, claiming frustration due to the fact that the agency had no continuing role to play in the UK. It didn't need the premises anymore. But the court held that even though the European agency would cease to have any role to play in the UK after Brexit, they could still pay the rent. And so the performance of their obligations under the lease was still possible, even if they were not physically in occupation. Force majeure. Well, force majeure isn't strictly law, is it? Fundamentally, we have to remember that force majeure is not a legal concept in English law, but rather it's entirely dependent on the force majeure clause being included in the contract. And whether that force majeure clause will give relief for the effects of Brexit depends entirely on how it's drafted. However, if I were to generalize, most force majeure clauses are drafted to deny relief where the cause was reasonably foreseeable. And it's hard for anyone to argue that Brexit and its effects were not reasonably foreseeable, at least since 2016 and arguably even before then. So there we are. Quite unlikely that a party will get relief from the effects of Brexit unless there's a clause expressly giving them relief.
Let me jump in there, Tony, and ask the big question. I guess part one is, post Brexit, will we still need to use French legal terms such as force majeure? And assuming we are able to continue to use them, where do you see the market going post Brexit?
Yeah, well, the second of those is a good question. When new risks arise in a marketplace, they tend over time to gravitate to the party best placed to manage that risk. So on balance, I think we will see suppliers tending to absorb the new performance related risks, but quite probably with them charging higher prices as a result. I think also for a while we'll see shorter term contracts while parties are still feeling their way as to how Brexit is going to play out for them. And possibly from an operational point of view, rather contractual, we'll probably see more overseas businesses setting up UK hubs from which to supply, and vice versa, more UK businesses setting up supply hubs in the EU. So there we are. We've covered a lot of topics, none of them really in enough depth. We could have talked about them for much longer, but we hope it's given you a good idea of just how many aspects of Brexit might impact on commercial agreements. So just to sum up and bring this session to a close, thank you all for watching. We hope it's been of interest to you. If you'd like to follow up with us on anything, then by all means, get in touch. Do please have a go at answering the quiz questions that are linked to this webinar. But for now, from Simon and me, it's goodbye and happy Brexit.